But Yatar Yitzchok Ba Hashem Lenochal Teish Tov. So Yitzchok and Rivka were having trouble having kids. And he started to speak to God. So Yitzchok davened across from his wife. Ki Akara Hi, because she was barren, she wasn't able to have children. But Yasir Lo Hashem, Hashem listened to Yitzchok's tefilos. Batar Rivka Ishto, and Rivka got pregnant. But Yisrotetzu Abonim Bekirba, and then the kid, she didn't know, started to make noise in her stomach. Batomer, and she said, Imkin Loma Ze Anochi, Batelech Lidroshes Hashem. So she was in pain, she was suffering, she was confused. So she went to find out what's going on. Vayomer Hashem Lo, she got the shame. Shame got a prophecy, and he shared it with her. Shnei Goyim Bevitech, there are two nations in your stomach. And two destinies, two countries are going to come out of your womb. In context means that when one is strong, the other will be weak. When the other will be strong, then the first one will be weak. There's going to be a competition forever for the history of the world. And it's interesting because she was comforted by this. She was in pain, she was suffering, she was confused, she didn't understand what the pains are. And then she found out that she's going to have an evil son. And that was very comforting for her to find out. We'll get back to that. And then later after Yaakov and Esav, they're born, they grow up, they get older. We know the stories, we're not going to repeat them. But one pasuk stands out. It sets the stage for what we're going to speak about tonight. After Yaakov, finally, he bought the brachos, and then he capitalized on it. He got the brachos. He snuck in. He tricked him. He didn't trick him. Esav shows up, and he finds out what happened. And his response is very simple. Vayistum Esav is Yaakov al bracha asher berchal aviv. So Esav harbored resentment is a light word. He harbored a very strong hatred against Yaakov. Vayomer Esav Belibo, and he said in his heart, Yikruvu Yimei Evel Avi. I'll just wait till Dad dies, till Yaakov, till Yitzchak dies. Vaharga is Yaakov Avi. And then I'll take that opportunity to get rid of my brother Yaakov. Here's a Ramban. It's a couple parshas later, but it talks about these stories. And he says, I'm going to read you one line, and then we'll talk. Ramban says about this battle between Yaakov and Esav. Nechdeva parsha azos lo'odia. This whole storyline was told to us to inform us. Ki kol asher iro la'avinu im Esav achiv. Everything that happened to our forefather, to Yaakov, in regards to Esav, his brother, Yara lanu tamid in b'nei Esav. It's going to happen to us constantly with our brother Esav. Throughout the Gullus, those interactions that they shared, we will consistently share those same interactions with the nation that Esav produced. M'pnei shehaya kabbalah b'yadam shezu parshas Gullus. Because these stories, this whole long escapade between Yaakov and Esav, this is the storyline of Gullus. Mistakil b'parshas zu l'lechis achari atzis azokin achocham. And listen carefully and watch closely to every detail in these parshas to follow Yaakov's advice and to follow his ways. Ki mimenu yiru hadoros v'chein yazu. Because from him the generations will learn, and so too you should follow. I just want to preface that on an average Thursday night, I try to find an issue, something that's important, that's relevant. And I'll try my best, just one issue, just to make it impactful. Tonight I'm not going to talk about an issue. I'm going to talk about what I feel is the issue, the overarching issue that covers everything. We'll start with a story. So everybody, when they're growing up, as an older brother, a cousin, that they look up to, hoping to one day become that cool figure from your childhood. I didn't have an older brother, so for me, that figure was a guy named Mike Gaglione. Mike Gaglione was a 6'2 guard. playing for St. Athanasius High School in Brooklyn, New York. He was scouted by Hofstra and St. John's. Mike was my next door neighbor. Now, honestly, Mike would have never given a Jew boy like me a second look, if not for the fact that my house, he had the best half court on the block. Now, I knew, everybody reminded me, but it was obvious, Mike was using me. When Mike comes over, you don't ask questions. You call your friends to watch the legend. Every weeknight and around the clock on weekends, Mike would do his routine. 200 foul shots, 153 pointers, throwing alley-oops off the backboard. He was getting ready. He wanted to go pro, but for sure for D1 ball. Now my game, personally, was slightly more modest. My mouth was my best weapon on the court. When Mike would come over, classic seventh grade trash talk, make fun of his mom, make fun of his girlfriend, say his girlfriend is a mom. Nothing too original. But Mike would keep his composure, hitting those 18-foot jumpers, breaking ankles with his crossovers. One time, there was only one time, that I actually got under his skin. And then when he came back, he says to me, "Ben, you know, I would say I'm gonna take you to school right now. That would be too easy. Nah, Ben, I'm gonna take you straight to shul." And threw an alley-oop off the backboard, and he dunked on me. One Sunday morning, after my parents renovated my house, I realized for the first time that Mike never came in. I never invited Mike in. I thought that was maybe something ungracious of me, like we weren't connected enough, but I did feel very close to Mike. So I said, "You know, like we renovated the house, why don't you come take a look? My bedroom's different. I just want to show you around." So he came in and I showed him around, and I felt it was very friendly and very nice. Later that night, my mom came home. She asked me about my day. And I told her, you know, we played basketball, Mike came over, what I ate for lunch, what was going on. And then I told Mike, you know, Mike came in and I showed him around. She said, "Who's Mike? What do you mean Mike came in? Which Mike came in?" I'm like, "What do you mean which Mike? Mike Galeone, the legend." So my mom looked at me when she heard that with eyes, piercing eyes. I never saw before that, and I never saw again. My mom looked at me after I told her that, and she says to me, "Never again. Never again do you bring a guy into my house." I said, "Whoa. Mom, relax." But in context, I get it. I got it. I worked it out. My mom's parents are survivors. My mom grew up suspicious of every non-Jew down the block. She was used to this. That was her mentality. She was what I call paranoid. Her and all her friends, and the entire generation, paranoid. I heard a story from Moshe Weinberger. He said it over a few years back. You see, when he was a kid, he came out of shul one day. And right when they came out, everybody came out together, and they saw across the street on the building a big red spray-painted swastika. And all the dads took their kids and they said, "Just don't look, let's get out of here, let's keep going. Don't pay attention." Rav Weinberger said that his dad took him by the arm, across in the street, he walked up to that swastika, and he said, you look and you look good, and you think about this and you remember this. This is what they think of you. And I heard that story, and I have the same mentality. We all have the same mentality. It's that generation, a generation of paranoid people with terrible, awful experiences that thank God we don't have, but they're paranoid. Every time they see something, they anticipate war, the entire generation. They glean from the attitude of Yaakov, who when he did have that showdown with Esav a few parshas later, that was his first thought. Esav's coming to kill me. Esav's coming to hurt me. Esav's coming to destroy me. It's a culture of Jews who are suspicious about the non-Jews' every move. Whereas we, and it's genuine, we genuinely believe that they've come to love us. They've come to appreciate us. They've come to understand us. We look at that generation and we brand them as paranoid. And they look at us and they call us naive. And I wonder who's right. There's an interesting storyline a little bit later, a few parshas down the line. Shechem goes and he captures Dina and he rapes her and he takes her as a wife. And Shimon and Levi, the brothers, they would have none of that. They go to Shechem with a proposition and they tell him, they worked out an agreement, your whole town will get a bris milah. You and everybody, we'll give you all a bris milah and then we'll let you take her sister, we'll let you keep Dina. Townspeople agreed. And it was all a scam. On the third day after the bris milah, truth came out. Shimon and Levi came with their swords. They destroyed the whole population of Shechem. And the story is very intriguing for two reasons. Shimon and Levi, they waited for the third day to destroy this village. Now, a few storylines later, they walk into Mitzrayim when Yosef took Binyamin captive, and they tell Yosef, we're going to overthrow the whole country of Egypt. A superpower. Two guys felt they were capable of overthrowing the whole superpower. But in a little village of Shechem, they need to give everybody a bris milah to make them weak? What do they need that for? The immediate response afterwards, Yaakov was paranoid. He said, what'd you do? Why'd you kill out the whole city? Now all the non-Jewish neighbors around us, they're going to all come together and attack us. But it never happened. Why not? So there's a joke, but it's not a joke. But it's not true. It's a joke, but it's not a joke. The leader of ISIS calls Mr. Abbas, the leader of the Palestinian nation, and he says, I don't get it. You kill every day. You're shooting rockets. You're digging tunnels. You're doing everything you can. Going into people's homes, murdering families, stabbing people on the street. Your constitution calls for the annihilation of the Jewish people. You preach genocide. And yet, what's the response? World leaders respect you. The UN defends you. College kids around the country, they support the Palestinian, the plight of your people. And me, says the leader of ISIS, what did I do? A bomb at a concert, a stabbing over here, a shooting in a nightclub. How many people did I kill already? And when they respond to me, they declare war on ISIS, the organization that they feel is the leader of Muslim terrorism. How'd you get away with it? What's your trick? What'd you convince the whole world of? We do the same thing, don't we? To which Abbas replies, the same thing? You call that the same thing? You kill people. Tens, hundreds. You kill people. How do you expect them to respond when you're killing people? But me? I kill Jews. When you kill Jews, nobody bats an eyelash. Nobody loses a night of sleep. Nobody cares. So Shimon and Levi had a genius tactic. We don't want Yaakov's nightmare to come true, that the nations around us should come and attack. We'll give them all a bris milah. Convert them all to our religion. Nobody will bat an eyelash. Nobody will respond. And sometimes it does feel, for myself also, when I hear this type of stories, when I hear this type of mentality, that we do play the anti-Semitism card a little too much. We use it as a ploy to garner world compassion. But it's not what I'm trying to do tonight. That's certainly not our goal. Tonight I want to explain to you, I want to discover with you our destiny. I want to work together with you to understand where we're going. Where the Jewish nation is headed. But we don't have a lot of time. So you'll excuse me as I skip over the oppression of Rome and Greece. We're going to overlook for now the brutality of the Crusades. We're going to ignore the blood libels, the pogroms, the inquisitions. There's a lot to talk about. But maybe I'll take just one brief stop in history, in recent history, and it's very small. I chose something minuscule, tiny, entirely overlooked. Nobody even heard about this. I'm going to share with you a story that happened that didn't matter to anyone in the scheme of things, didn't matter in the history of mankind. But it says a lot, and the small stories are the biggest stories because they say everything. One day in July 1941, half of the population of a small East European town murdered the other half. Some 1,600 men, women, and children were killed. Men and women were hacked to death with knives, iron hooks, and axes. Small children were thrown with pitchforks onto a bonfire. A woman's decapitated head was kicked around like a football. Local townsmen. I'm not talking about Nazis right now. The time you got right, it's 1941. We're not talking about Germans. We're not talking about any regime. We're talking about local townspeople throwing around babies, a decapitated head like a soccer ball. The townsmen grabbed clubs studded with nails and other weapons and chased the Jews into the street. They shoved the remaining hundreds of Jews into a barn, doused it with kerosene, and set it ablaze. Some on the outside, some of these townsmen, these refined townsmen, played classical music on the outside to drown out the screams. A new film, Aftermath, brings that message to the screen. The film star, a Polish actor, received death threats, and in several online forums, there were comments such as, "You are not a Pole anymore. You are now a Jew." Regular stories to regular people, not gas chambers, not Islamic Jihad. We're talking about the common citizen that live in your neighborhood, in your town. You just don't see it. And from the Holocaust survivors, you hear, and you don't believe it, but you hear, and it sounds very strange, and you can't fathom it could be true, but you hear, "We were friendly with them 2 days ago. And then all it took was overnight. We don't even know what happened. And they all turned against us. They were our friends in school. They were our co-workers. They came over to eat. We shared with them our lives. And overnight, it disappeared." When we hear this, we have a difficult time. Because we think to ourselves, maybe it's just small pockets of the world. But I'll read to you, not the manifesto, but a few words from it. Written in the diary of Joseph Goebbels, Yimach Shemo V'Zichro. He wrote, these diaries were so valuable for people to get their hands on, to understand the philosophy and the psychology of the Nazi war machine and the Nazi mentality. It didn't start in the 1930s, though. This is a manifesto that is 3,000 years old. He just put it into words. He starts off and he says, "The Jewish question is again giving us a headache. This time, however, not because we have gone too far, because we are not going far enough. We must hasten the process with cold ruthlessness. We shall thereby render an inestimable service to humanity, who has been tormented for thousands of years by the Jews. The Führer expressed the idea vigorously and repeated it afterward to a group of officers, and he said they can put it in their pipes and smoke it. The Jewish race is the most dangerous one that inhabits this globe." I'm saying it loud because you got to hear this clear. "The Jewish race, you are the most dangerous race that inhabits this globe." That's how they see you. Don't lie to yourself. It's a conspiracy. I'm trying to scare you. I have no agenda. I have no motive. I'm telling you facts. We must show them no mercy and no indulgence. They must be eliminated and destroyed conclusively. Otherwise, it will never be possible to bring peace to the world. A judgment is being visited upon the Jews that, while barbaric, is fully deserved by them. It's a life and death struggle between the Aryan race and the Jewish bacteria. And I believe, says Mr. Goebbels, Yimach Shemo, that the English and the Americans will be happy that we are exterminating the dirt of humanity. This was not created in the 30s. This hasn't changed in the 60s and the 80s and at any time in recent history. We hear this all the time. Over the past 3,000 years, the torch of hatred has been passed from one country to the next. Italy to Spain, France to Russia, England and Germany. There's barely a nation in existence today that has not taken part in this international Jew-killing spree. And our response? How do we respond to this? The best way I understand is there was a Jew who sat in a cattle car on his way to Treblinka. And he knew exactly, they all knew exactly where they were going. And he sat thinking about his family that he'll never see again, thinking about the future that he'll never experience, thinking about his friends. A matter of minutes, they'll all be gone. And as he sat in that cattle car, all he heard was the thump. He heard the train against the tracks, and it went dun, 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 dun. That's all he heard as these thoughts went through his mind. Dun, 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 dun. And in his head, he thought of words that are the classic response, the way we treat every experience in every century, in every generation. And he created a melody based to the words as he sat there, the only thought that could go through his head. Ani mamin, ani mamin. That maybe it's going to end. Maybe the ending is around this corner. How many corners do we need to go through? Maybe the light is at the end of this tunnel. Maybe this is going to be the last one. Maybe after now we'll finally see what we've been waiting so long to see. Hope. That's all we had. Through centuries. Through generations. This is the family tradition passed down from one dad to the next. Hope. Because we know what's real. We know it's coming again. We know it's just a matter of time till it rears its ugly head. And maybe the hope is slowly coming alive. We stand today, maybe bruised, but we're comfortable. We're settled. Maybe the final bell is rung. Auschwitz and its gas chambers today are historical sites that we pay money to visit. We go to the ashes at Majdanek and we confidently claim, never again. Whether you're at home in Teaneck or the Five Towns, or even Budapest and Frankfurt, nobody's scared of having a pogrom tomorrow morning in your local Young Israel. But those who are left, those who really understand this deeply, they're left to wonder, is it really all over? Has Esav stopped the chase? Has the 3,000-year chase ended in what we think and what we see is the final loving embrace? You can't help but sometimes look both ways and over your shoulder and wonder, when is it going to happen again? So we'll look one last time back into the story of Gullus. And it's in a few weeks, we're going to read when Yaakov prays, when the showdown happens with Esav, he says a funny thing. He said, God, Hatzileni no miyad ochi miyad Esav. Save me from Esav, but he proceeds that from my brother. And he repeats that over and over again. Save me from my brother, from Esav. Which is obviously redundant. We all know that they're brothers. There's something deeper that he's alluding to when he keeps saying, save me from Esau, from my brother. And when they do finally meet, what a family reunion it is. Vayaratz Esau the crossover Yechabkehu. There's only a loving embrace. Esau runs right to Yaakov and gives him a big hug. Vayishikehu, and he kisses him. Vayomer Nesov and Elecho Lanidecha. Let's go together. Why the tension? Why the animosity? Let's go back. Let's be a family. Let's be brothers. Let's walk into history holding hands. To which Yaakov responds, nah, Yavor no Adoni. You know, you go ahead. Why didn't you just go ahead? Lifnei Avodah, lifnei me and my family. Adashir Avo El Adoni Seira. We'll catch up by Seira. Rashi says from Chazal, Seira means at the end of days. I'll catch up at the end of... Now, Esav wants to make peace. You give your brother a break. Hold hands. Walk through history together. What are you afraid of? Why was Yaakov so hesitant to walk together? I'm going to tell you a mashal right now, and stay with me. And this mashal is going to start tonight's discussion. Summer and winter, look down. And they saw a group of people around the bonfire. And the bonfire, the flames are growing. And summer and winter debated, who can get the flames to go out? How can we extinguish the fire? And so summer says to winter, you seem so confident. Why don't you go first? So winter comes out, starts to lower the temperature from 50 to 40 to 20, freezing. And suddenly you see the people, they're putting more wood into the fire. They're lighting up the flames, and the fire only gets bigger. So winter comes and starts pouring down rain, and the people build a roof over the fire, making sure they have enough warmth to survive. And then he comes with the pounding wind, and they build a wall around the fire, only making the fire bigger and stronger. And it's an interesting thing that as hard as winter fought, the people know that the only way they're going to survive is if they keep this fire alive. They got to keep this fire going. So as hard as winter's going to fight, we're going to fight much harder to keep ourselves strong. So winter, he deferred. And now summer, go ahead. Summer comes out, shines its glorious rays. Temperature rises from 40 to 50 to 70, 80 degrees. Rooftop comes off. The people destroy the walls. They bring out their buckets, fill it with water. You didn't have to do anything. And next thing you know, they extinguish the flames themselves. Sometime, when you got to fight for something, you fight hard and you keep fighting. But sometimes, when there's no reason to fight, when it's very easy, you could just extinguish the flames yourself. There was a teenager who went over to his grandpa, and he wondered, he's doing a project for school, and he said, Grandpa, I don't understand. You talk about the good life you had in Poland, the simplicity. Why'd you make your way over to America? What was it that got you to make that big trip with your whole family, leaving everything you knew and were comfortable? Why'd you come to America? And he says to his grandson, he says, you don't understand. In Poland was terrible. In Poland, they didn't let us have religious freedom. I was going to be drafted into an army, he told his grandson. In that army, they forced Jews to cut off their peyos, to shave their beards, to get rid of their tzitzis. You weren't allowed to wear tefillin. They controlled everything about you. So the grandson looks to his grandfather and he says, Grandpa, you don't have a beard. You don't have peyos. I never saw you wearing tzitzis or tefillin. Who controls you now? Who did this to you now? I'll tell you who. I had a friend in Binghamton. Went to Israel for the year. He did fantastic. And he was this kind of guy, he says, I'm going to go to Bing and I'm going to show everybody that I can do it and I can do it well. And he was flying, he was soaring sky high. Shabbos, perfect. Kashrus, amazing. Learning, minyan, he got all the bases covered. I was with him one summer after his freshman year, and he was talking himself up with pride, and he deserved it. And he said, you know what? I killed it. My Rebbeim in Israel told me I won't be able to do it. I'm going to fall. I only grew. I didn't fall an ounce. Nothing. Davening, kashrus, learning, boom, boom, boom. Knocked them all off. And you know what? It wasn't just religiously. Like they told me socially I'll have a hard time. It was even better socially. Picked me up a girlfriend, he tells me. Ooh, good for you. Not that kind of kid. Good for you. That's good for you. And he says, you know what? I got a picture. You got to take a look. He pulls it out. He shows me. I'm like, what? I said, are you kidding me? He says, not bad, not bad. I said, are you joking me? He says, what? I said, she's Chinese. And he says, excuse me, she is Korean. I said, I don't care if this girl's made in Vietnam. You're dating an Asian girl? And he said, come on. You know I was always into that. I said, you went to Israel for the year. He says, I went to raise shit. I'm like, you're Shomer. I used to be Shomer. You wear your tzitzis out. That's how we met. She loves the blue. The blue is what got her. If you think that the strongest weapon that Esav has is his sword, let's compare. In the 1940s, he annihilated 6 million Jews by the sword. Does that compare to the 9 million Jews we lost in a much friendlier way? The intermarriage rate in 1970 was 11%. 11% of Jews in America in 1970 married out. The intermarriage rate in 2013, by a Pew study, these are not made up facts, is 71%. The intermarriage rate has gone up 700%. That means that the Goldbergs of the 70s have become the O'Haras. The Berkowitzes are now the Johnsons, and the Cohens are now Gonzalez. Maybe not Gonzalez, but. There are 9 million church-going kids today with Jewish dads, giving up their history and their heritage. So I wonder, maybe Esav's plan is actually picking up steam. Maybe Esav thought to himself, if I by myself can't annihilate them, maybe I could create the perfect environment for them to annihilate themselves. Chazal took the message. They understood that more than Yaakov was afraid of his enemy Esav, he was afraid of the brotherly love that Esav could give. So they set up ways to distance ourselves. They set up laws like Bishul Akum. You can't eat food that was cooked by a non-Jew. They set that up, Mishum Chasnas, that we shouldn't intermarry. They gave the reason for the law. And we mock it. We hear these laws, you can't eat food that was cooked by Maria. Maria? Maria can't cook my food? Mishum Chasnas? Because I might marry her? I'm saying, who? Who's going into Dunkin' Donuts and marrying the Puerto Rican girl behind the counter? This is something I need to be concerned about. So we're critical of their warnings. We doubt their intuition. And what happens next? So maybe my mom wasn't so paranoid. Because maybe it's specifically because I never invited Mike Galeone back into my house that he didn't marry my sister. But he married somebody else's. Mike brought his Catholicism into a Jewish girl's life. Mike married in, she married out, whatever you want to call it. Little did Mike know that a few years after that comment, he'll be driving his own little kids to shul. So the final solution is not a thing of the past. On the contrary, it's picking up a lot of steam. But you know, most of us here, we're not nervous. Because yeah, we get it. We heard about it. Yeah, I have an uncle. I have a couple, we all do. a cousin who married out. It happens. Who left the fold, annihilating the remnant of his future family from the Jewish nation. But it's not going to happen to me. So Esav says, more than your brother, let's walk side by side. You know what? Maybe you're safe. Maybe I can't kill you with the sword. Maybe I can't make you extinguish your own flames. So if I can't get you to marry a guy, he says, maybe I can turn you into one. Years ago, if you were the kind of kid who listens to ASAP Rocky, Lil Baby, you shop for your gangster rap apparel at a store called FUBU. There's a guy named Jason. Jason was the captain of the Frisch hockey team. He was a Lil Baby guy. Jason got his dad to take him one Sunday afternoon to the mall. And where else do they go but the gangster rap store called FUBU? And he's looking around at the sneakers. They love their sneakers. And the jeans and the hats. They like their hats. And Jason's dad, he notices something in the store. And he whispers, because he doesn't think Jason picked up on this. And he says, Jason, come over here. Jason, get over here. And Jason goes to his dad and he says, Dad, what's up? What's going on? He says, Jason, look around. Look around, Jason. We're the only two white guys in here. Jason turns to his dad and he says, correction, Dad. You're the only white guy in here. And on sports day, you look around. You got your classic James and Durant. Now, honestly, I can't say I know everyone's names. But there's no way somebody here is named Jokic or Porzingis or Antetokounmpo. But there are role models. We grow up watching their every move. We grow up idolizing them. Their posters are on our wall. There are every thought in our every day. And it makes you wonder, 6 million had to die like a Jew so I could live like a guy? There's only about 9% of Jewish people in the world, in America today, who keep mitzvot. 9% who consider themselves Orthodox. In contrast to 79% of non-Jews who believe in God, I gotta quote the study because this sounds crazy. A 2003 study showed that 79% of non-Jews believe in God and 48% of Jews. Oh, they got control. Oh, we're going downhill. Intermarriage. We don't believe anymore. We don't know anymore. Assimilation is happening faster than the birth rate. That means that the Jewish population is declining because the more kids we have doesn't help. There's more people marrying out. Now, I know the reaction. It's still, come on. I'm not part of that pogrom. I'm not part of that. I went to TABC. I went to DR. It's an all-boys school. I went to an all-boys school with a base, with good, and you did. So what do I, I'm not a casualty of this war. I deleted my Snapchat. I got a filter on my phone. I'm good. I'm telling you, I'm good. So let's have a deeper look. Have we defeated Esav in all of his plans? We covered all the bases? Chazal tell us that there's three averos that are Yaro Valyavor. Eshvichas Damim, Avodah Zarah, and Gilui Arayos. Now that means, if you don't realize, that means that if a guy puts a gun to your head and he says, bow down to the idol, you got to take the bullet. If a guy puts a gun to your head and he says, decide who I kill, decide who dies, you got to take the bullet. And if a guy says, Gilui Arayos, to do something inappropriate with a woman, you got to take the bullet. Now, two out of three I got. I've seen these holocausts. I've seen when the Jews got to bow down. That's the history of that's been for thousands of years. I've seen those threats, and we've taken those bullets. I've heard stories about Shvichas Damim, that the guy puts a gun to the head, and you got to decide who's going to die. Which kid? Is the dad? Is the uncle? Who's going to die? You take the bullet. But which holocaust was a guy putting a gun to your head for Gilui Arayos? Some people want to be in that holocaust. When did that happen? What are we afraid of? What guy is going to put it? Where is this happening? I was there. We were all there. I went to a Yankee game a few years ago. Seventh inning stretch. I'm doing my little dance. You know, they're leading, but I'm following. I'm doing a little dance. And then I see on the big screen a couple. It's like a classic post-Shana Aleph couple. You got the guy, he's tucked in, and the khaki pants, and you can see like a little white going around the belt. Classic. And he's with his girlfriend. You know, she's got that post-seminary look. And I see his couple, and I say, that's adorable. That is adorable. And then I see like a heart that starts throbbing on the screen above them. And then before I even know what's going on, not 5 seconds later, you got 50,000 people in the Bronx chanting, kiss her, kiss her, kiss. And I'm looking at this guy and nobody knows. Nobody, he's wearing a hat, so nobody knows. But I'm looking at this guy's eyes and he looks at her and I know exactly what he's thinking. He's looking at her and he's like, we just became Shomer like 2 weeks ago. And she's looking at him and she's thinking like, yeah, but 2 weeks ago we weren't. And I'm watching 50,000 goyim chanting, kiss her, kiss her, asking him, asking her to drop their morals, to drop their values, to drop the religious commitments that they just made. I'm watching 50,000 non-Jews, no guns, without violence, in the friendliest way, chanting him to do what the Ramah says in Yoredeya, in Kufnun Zayin. I'm quoting a source because you're going to think I'm crazy. To do something that the Ramah says is Yaharog Va'al Yavor. The first time this Holocaust existed at Citi Field, at every baseball stadium, at MSG, at every basketball game, you just don't know if it's them. The Holocaust is here. And all he thinks, we're just trying to blend in. We're just trying to go unnoticed. We put on the hat. We want to be a part of their culture. We want to think, we want them to think that we are them and they are us. And there's no difference between us. Isn't that what you're all trying to do? It starts with our leaders. 34 congressmen today are Jewish. 203 Nobel Prize winners. This is the pride. We glorify ourselves. This is the pride of our nation. 34 congressmen. That's triple what should be expected based on our population. 203 Nobel Prize winners. That's 23%. As opposed to our population, which is less than 1% of mankind. The pride, the glory of Judaism. That's how we name it. And I hate to say this, but to me, I look a little deeper and I see from these 203 and from these 34, a handful know what Torah is. Maybe a couple keep any mitzvot. The vast majority are married out. This is a testimony. This is a glaring testimony to the annihilation of our people, to the end of the Jewish nation. And this is our pride. This is what we speak up about the greatness of Judaism. This is the destruction of Judaism. Their people have reached the highest levels of society who have abandoned their Judaism, who have given it up entirely. And that's our leaders. And it trickles down into us. So some of us, again, not part of that pogrom. So you come to yeshiva and you feel like, wait, I'm getting better. I want to be more a part of what's real and what's good. And you come and we sit here for the year, for two, and we challenge you spiritually, emotionally, religiously. But you prefer to escape your heritage. You run to their challenges, to their Harlem shakes. You run to their ice buckets. You know, they have you turning into mannequins before you know it. And you say it's not going to get to you, but eventually it's in my feelings. You can't just swiftly shake this off. But maybe you tell yourself you can blend worlds. I can do it both. I can master them both. I could pull it off. So let me tell you about blending worlds. Senior year, winter break at Cancun. So the boys that I was friendly with, a little less religious than the average guy in the TIV. It was one of us who was keeping Shabbos. And he was the classic guy who at the Met game would go to the mincha by the hot dog stand. He was the guy who would sneak out of prom and daven a quick ma'ariv. But for the most part, we didn't know and we didn't care. So it was Saturday afternoon. It was getting a little dark. And we were sitting out there listening to a new up-and-coming artist named Jay-Z. And we were like, this guy's not bad. This guy's not bad. He might become something one day. And then this one guy, this mincha at City Field guy, he says, guys, we got to head back to the hotel. I'm like, nah, we're having a sick time. We want to pull it back. He says, I'm telling you, just do me a favor. Like, I need this. We got to go back to the hotel right now. So we follow him, good friends, get back to the hotel, don't know what's up his sleeve. And all of a sudden, he takes out a cup, and then he double cups it. We never seen this. He double cups it. He pours it to the brim with Corona. And then in the background, you hear like, nine, 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 nine. And then he lights up a couple cigarettes, gives it to the other guy standing, and this guy's standing like this. Nine, 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 nine. And I know everyone's kasha, but you don't have to worry, because there was besamim over the whole room. And he said, we're going to blend worlds. He said, we're going to do a Jay-Z style. And then he reads the words. And he says, Hamavdil ben Kodesh l'chol. Hamavdil ben Yisrael l'amin. And looking back, I think about this, and I say to myself, in that speech, he said, Hamavdil ben Yisrael l'amin. And he's trying to blend worlds. And he's quoting Hamavdil ben Yisrael l'amin. That were supposed to be different, ben Kodesh l'chol. That were supposed to be better. That were not supposed to be the same. That were not supposed to be blended. And look what happened when you blended. Look where they've gone. Look how far. They've disappeared. They don't exist anymore. They're all gone. But we get a good laugh. And nobody's bothered. We take the best of both worlds. And we say, I can pull it. You can. You can't pull this off. Really? You've done a great job, right? So let's see. We teach you about Avram looking up, stargazing. All you can think about is Travis Scott. The dreams your parents had for you. You traded in those dreams for Lucid Ones by Juice WRLD. We tell you to return to Zion, and all you think about is when he's coming back from his knee injury. After a year in the TIV, somebody told me, they got you good. They got you brainwashed real good. And I said to him, you know what? It's been a year in the TIV. 1 year, they got me real good. You've been in America 20 years. Imagine how good they got you. All we're trying to tell you here is that life is serious, that religion is real. But for some, it's too late, because Esav already convinced you that it's just a Game of Thrones. We introduce you to Rav Nevinson, showing you what it means to be humble. You prefer Kendrick Lamar's version. When we get to the peak, we talk about God's plan, but you prefer to listen to Drake preach about it. You know, the family, the Rebbeim, we try to put you on the right path, but you're just so comfortable on the old town road. I know it's childish, Gambino. But this is America. They've brainwashed you well, convincing you of what your call of duty is. All it took was a fortnight. This is cute, right? This is real cute. But look around. Look at the product. Some haven't worn tzitzis in years. Disregard tefillin. Keep half Shabbos at best. You take a poll, seniors in Yeshiva League, I don't believe 50% keep Shabbos. You memorized every line and every scene in Hangover. You don't know four lines of Gemara. You use up all your intelligence calculating quarterback ratings and parlays. You don't know 10 Mishnayos. 5. 3. Let's bid. 2. 1. Not 1. The talented stand in front of a mirror practicing their flaws and nay nay. No aspirations to finish Shas. No thoughts to become a Talmud Chacham. No interest to develop Kedusha. All you want and care about is to become the next Wolf of Wall Street. Instead of learning from wise, educated men, you prefer Mad Men and The Walking Dead. The whole life that you live is a fantasy. The only touch you have to reality is the Kardashians and The Bachelorette. You have no problem eating out dairy. Fast days aren't a thing. You can't translate a pasuk. You don't know your Hebrew birthday. We pulled it off. We did it. Look around. We killed it. We blended the worlds. We did it so well. And it pains me. Because you wonder, I wonder, we should all wonder. What happened? We come from such loving Jewish families who tried to instill Torah and mitzvahs. They've been abandoned. You've abandoned your families. You've abandoned them for the families that you spend much more time with or much stronger influences in your life. Pushed aside mom and dad to spend time with We're the Millers, Family Guy, Step Brothers, How I Met Your Mother. Those are the adult influences in our lives. You push aside good friends and good influences for old seasons with Joey and Chandler. And so maybe, I'm left to wonder, just maybe, the final solution is no longer a thing of the past. On the contrary, it's picking up a lot of steam. Asaf sits back with a Corona and 2 cigarettes. Let's watch them burn. They'll do it on their own. I don't need to get involved. Jewish kids raised in Jewish communities, going to Jewish schools, can't read a Gemara, can't understand Hebrew, and they know every detail of every aspect of non-Jewish culture. Correction, Dad. You're the only white guy in here. Because we're gone. We're part of that. That's who we are. Rivka's worst nightmare. Because when it's kicking, when she walks by a Beis Medrash, and when it's kicking, when she walks by a house of Avodah Zarah, that's her worst nightmare. That the kid wants to blend the worlds. And she finds out, no, it's 2 kids. And she breathes freely. But what do you kick for? When do you kick? For Governor's Ball. You kick. Life in color makes you kick. Only reason you kick at the Kotel is because you heard Messi showing up today. If I can't annihilate them by making Christmas parties with swords and knives and guns, I'm going to invite them to the Christmas parties. I'll defeat them by inviting them. Maybe we'll get to a point that Thanksgiving will be more anticipated than Rosh Hashanah. It's no coincidence that the more you are engrossed in their world, the less you are in ours. So if they've convinced you that this is who you are, I want to take you a step back to when you were 6 or 7 years old, and we were all there. We were all there. When you were 6 or 7 years old, your mom, your teacher said to you, who wants to do a mitzvah? And you were the first guy to raise his hand. Where'd that kid go? What'd they do to that kid? When you were 13 years old, your father gave you tefillin, and you put it on with such enthusiasm, and such where is that kid? Who killed that kid? Who destroyed that child? He was there. He was alive. He was happy. He was enthusiastic. He was inspired. That child is still there. But they covered him up. You got your first sitter. These were all exciting. These were all things that you were a part of and you wanted to continue. But they've been contaminated. The Torah is our culture. The Talmidei Chachamim are our pride and glory. Open your eyes. You're the last strand of Jewish life. 9% of Jews in America keep Shabbos. 9% of Jews in America know what Torah is. You're the last hope. If you don't up the ante You're going to end up folding all the cards. This is the battle of our generation. This is the final solution, and it's a well-oiled machine. But it's time to fight back. Instead of going back, running back, kicking back to another show on Netflix, another stupid YouTube video, another Instagram, another Snapchat. Is it not embarrassing for you when you sit on that stoop downstairs by the door? Is that not embarrassing for you? You don't feel ashamed that you're in the most, you could gain so much. You could accomplish so many great things here. And you stoop yourself to a level to sit on that stoop every morning, afternoon, and evening to just go one stupidity after the next. Meaningless culture that just contaminates and doesn't benefit you in any way. You're not embarrassed. There's nothing ashamed about doing that. It's still there. An extra half hour in the base. An extra kavanah. I'm not looking for overnight changes. This sounds extreme, like we gotta change drastically. You gotta change step, by understanding what life is, what you are, what you're capable, what you're a part of. What you're a part of. You're a part of something. The greatest thing in humanity. You're a part of the beginning, the middle, and the end of the world. You're a part of a nation that God chose. So I encourage you and I urge you, become a part of this. Invest in this. Put everything you got in this. We should have a lot of siyata dishmaya as individuals and as a group. To fight back. This is not a joke. We could laugh, we could smile. This is not a joke. The tide is pushing really hard in one direction. As individuals and as a group, we gotta put in more hours, we gotta put in more kavana, we gotta put in more energy and more effort. And we got this. We got this. And we could turn it around. One guy at a time, one family at a time, one community at a time. We got this. Chavez.